soldiered on. Behind me, the infantry hustled to stay close. One went down, and he didn't get back up. He'd taken a round in the throat. "They must have bought these rifles from Frontier 921 Worlds," I said. "I bet the Saurians are trading with them. Trade ships are breaking the Empire rules all over the place. Claver might be behind it. Funny, I'm surprised even Claver has the balls it takes to go up against the Empire."
"Funny, but not ha-ha funny," Carlos said. "Maybe the traitors know the score better than we do. They get around. Maybe the Empire isn't such a big threat anymore. We're the only ones out here trying to stop anyone from doing whatever they want to."
Carlos's words concerned me. He had a good point. Before I could come up with a response, Della cut in.
"The incoming fire is getting heavy," she reported.
She was up ahead of me, leading the first wave.
"Permission to employ our shields, veteran."
"Hell yeah. Do whatever you need to keep your dragons walking." I saw the lead machines shimmer, enclosing themselves in artificial fields. Sparks that had been pounding into metal now disintegrated without reaching the hulls of the dragons. I should have suspected that Harris had chosen shields in his loadout. As it had turned out, it was the right choice for this situation. Then again, he'd taken more losses getting off the lifter because his dragons had been slow. Now that we'd been tasked with marching up a hill, protecting infantry, the shields were an excellent advantage. They burned up energy reserves like there was no tomorrow, but I wished my dragon had them. I'd have switched them on in a heartbeat. Behind me, light troops tried to keep my churning legs between them and the incoming fire. The squid infantry above and ahead were still showering us with projectiles, but unfortunately they were firing blind. They couldn't see us visually due to the heavy mists. That said, they obviously knew where we were and that we were advancing. The storm of fire couldn't be stopped entirely by the dragons. Now and then one of the running infantry was hit and sent stumbling back down the slope. When we finally got to the next major outcropping of cover, Della reported that her power reserves were a quarter down. I ordered her machines to go into standby. They could recharge a little while my group stood guard. That's when I finally met the Solstice Centurion of the unit I was escorting. She was none other than Centurion Belter. Her group had been wiped out the last time we'd fought on this planet, the same as my squad had been.
"What a pleasant surprise," I said to her. "I didn't know you were marching up here with us, sir. Are you in command of this force?"
"Technically, yes," Belter said. "But I don't know anything about these new dragons and their capabilities. I want you to fight your cavalry as you see fit, veteran. You got us this far."
"Fair enough. Was it an accident that we were thrown in together?"
"Not at all, McGill. I requested the grouping after the confusion I witnessed while abandoning the lifter."
This surprised me. I couldn't recall the last time an officer had requested to throw their lot in with me. Especially not an officer from a rival legion. I was beginning to like Solstice. They weren't as famous as Victrix or Germanica, which were showboat outfits, in my opinion, more concerned with how they looked in the net news vids back home than anything else. Maybe Solstice people had a little humility and respect for others, due to their less storied past. They seemed like hard-bitten fighting troops, accustomed to dying without a thanks or ceremony. Their heavy troops wore armor that was covered in tarnish, dents, and burn marks. The light troops I was grouped with now were equally tough. I hadn't heard a complaint out of one of their mouths yet. About 5 minutes after we reached shelter, another 2 units of infantry and an additional cavalry squad joined us. None of the formations were full strength by now. We'd lost about 20% of our troops already, and we hadn't killed a single squid yet, as far as I could tell. Graves and Leeson were among those who joined us under the overhang.
"This is intolerable," Leeson complained. "What are we, a kilometer or so from the base? We can't climb another 9,000 meters under this kind of fire. Why didn't Turov just blast the squids from the sky to start with?"
"Because," Graves answered him in command chat, "we're trying to capture this frigging mountain full of titanium, not blow it up. The squids were ingenious to land here. They must have known they were safe."
"Either that," I said, "or they've already been mining here and meant to support this mountain as a base.
When they landed, they didn't know we were going to fire on their ships. They thought we had a deal.
Graves left the chat channel and contacted me privately.
Sir? I asked, opening the connection.
McGill, you always seem to have nuggets of illicit information. What do you mean the squids weren't expecting to be fired upon?
I realized I'd screwed up. I'd promised Turov I wouldn't mention she was in on the deal with Klaver from the start. Graves saved me from confessing, however. He'd already pretty much figured everything out.
So the scheme went deeper than I thought. Turov and Klaver had this arranged, probably months ago. I can only guess at your involvement. How do you get yourself into these things, McGill?
I'm not rightly sure, Centurion, I admitted. It must be due to my personal charismatic aura. He laughed. I took that moment to remind Graves about the native machines who had informed me that they were working for the squids. There are trails and familiar swirls all over the surface in this region, I said. To me, that indicates the local machine population frequents this spot.
You think the squids have machine allies here?
Graves asked me. Yes, I would estimate they do. These patterns in the rock and the ore, they're like identifying teeth marks for the machines. Graves wasn't happy with my news. If I was right, it meant we weren't just fighting a few thousand squids. We were facing an unknown number of native machines as well. Chapter 30. We got a break about an hour later. We were ordered to dig in and hunker down. Supporting fire was due to come down within a few hours. The orders were almost impossible to follow as we were on a mountain of titanium ore and methane ice, two substances that were anything but forgiving. We tried to dig foxholes anyway, but failed.
"It'll take an industrial drilling machine to penetrate this," Kiwi complained.
Her dragon's claws rasped and scratched pointlessly on the surface. "It's hard rock," I agreed. "Forget about it. Save your batteries. We'll close ranks and hug up against the overhang. Let's wait it out, everyone."
Belter already had her troops in a fold of protective rock that looked like a crack in the ground. Our dragons wouldn't fit, and I didn't want to have my pilots get out of them, so we stood awkwardly around and waited for whatever was coming our way. Fortunately, it wasn't the broadsides. Each broadside shell from a big ship was a fusion warhead. They didn't seem to come in designer shapes and sizes, either. They hammered with city buster force, or they didn't fire at all. What fell on top of the mountain instead was a much lighter attack, but still impressive. We saw the brilliant blue-white balls falling through the mist. Bright as an arc welder's torch, they could burn out your retina if you looked at them with the naked eye.
"Visors down, full shades," I ordered. My squad hastened to comply. I hadn't seen this kind of fire from the ships before. It was something new. But the look of grav plasma balls was unmistakable. They kept coming down, silent while they were in the atmosphere. But when they hit the ground and the physics effect was triggered, a resounding report rolled down the mountain.
"What are they doing?"
Carlos asked me. "As far as I can tell, they're silencing those missile batteries. Let's hope it works." Plasma attacks of this kind picked up smaller debris from the region affected and shot it outward in a spray like a fragmentation weapon that didn't have to bring along the fragments. Gravel, shards of ice, anything would do. They were tearing up the squids, I hoped, far up on the mountainside. Belter contacted me.
"We should advance now, while the enemy positions are under bombardment."
I felt unsure. Judging from the immediate vicinity, we weren't getting hit. But if those weapons were walked down slope and we were exposed, well, we might get taken out by our own artillery. That said, I was a new veteran and Belter was a Centurion. "All right," I said without voicing an objection. "Let's move out. Same formation as before. Della, turn on those shields." We were marching upslope again less than a minute later. Huffing and puffing, the infantry raced after us. Up ahead, we could see the blue-white flashes as the bombardment crashed down. Now and then bits of flying debris showered down, hitting machines and men alike. But as far as I could tell, the squids weren't shooting at us. They were trying to hide.
"McGill," Leeson shouted. "What are you doing? You're out of position."
"Sorry, sir," I said. "Centurion Belter ordered us to advance under the cover of artillery."
"She doesn't have the right. She's not even part of Legion Varus."
"That's an officer fight, sir," I said, marching my machine a fraction faster. A few snap rifle rounds were hitting my people now. They seemed to be coming from a nearby position.
"I'm just a vet, and this is a joint effort. I follow the orders of the officer who's walking behind me."
One problem with using multi-legion forces came to light when we performed joint missions, which had been a rare event in the past. Historically, our legions were independent rivals. Every legion was like an army from a small country, countries that didn't like each other all that much. Technically, we were all beholden to hegemony if push came to shove. But for nearly a century now, the individual legions hadn't had to listen to outside authority while out in the field. On this mission, we'd been told the two legions would be kept separate. Therefore, this kind of thing shouldn't have come up. I'd been briefed on the matter and knew that if it did, the officer on deck was in charge, as I'd told Leeson. Due to the confusion after our initial landing, we'd been forced to put legions and auxiliary cohorts into one force. The brass simply hadn't foreseen this kind of situation. But in my opinion, they should have. Cursing, Leeson broke off. I knew he'd go complain to Belter or maybe to Graves or even Winslade. It wasn't my problem. I kept marching my dragon, leading Belter's infantry to the next available pocket of cover. When we got there, we discovered something shocking. The location was already occupied by the enemy. We realized what we were marching into only when we plunged into their midst. They'd been hunkering down, ducking the bombardment that was landing mostly higher upslope. This group must have been one of the lowest posted enemy concentrations on the mountain. There were about 50 squids, all armed with snap rifles and wearing that scaled combat armor I'd seen on Dust World. It was thin, but tougher than it looked.
"Enemy contact!" I shouted,
cluing in Leeson, Belter, and every dragon rider in my squad.
"Use grenade launchers if you've got 'em."
Fortunately, most of my team did. Della's team didn't have launchers, as Harris had put those spinal cannons on them instead. The arrangement turned out to be a good one, however. Her team advanced into claw range, blasting a few rounds from their big guns as they came. The crack and blast of the shells was deafening, even through my dragon's armored chassis. Still shielded, Della's front line absorbed most of the enemy's snap rifle fire. The squids seemed surprised and unsure how to handle our marching death dealers. They poured automatic fire into the shielded dragons, but with little effect. Throwing themselves prone at the clawed feet of the dragons, Belter's infantry sprayed the squids with snap rifles of their own. The squid armor wasn't very effective at stopping this barrage, but squids don't die easily. Many fought on with limbs missing and dark blood pouring out of huge holes in their bodies. That's when my dragons got into the fight. We were armed with twin grenade launchers, and we tore them apart with the first volley. The enemy was a flopping mass of flesh after we hosed them down with grenades. I soon called a halt to the firing, and Belter's people charged in to finish the job. There was no mercy on our side. We killed every one of them. My lips were a tight line. I might have accepted any sign of surrender, but there wasn't any. Squids didn't think like that. They probably didn't find surrender honorable, or maybe they didn't understand the concept at all. They fought to the last, even killing a few troopers by constriction when they got in close. It was a harsh lesson for our dead soldiers who'd never encountered squids before. These aliens possessed a grim vitality. After it was over, Winslade himself contacted me. I opened the connection without relish.
"Primus, sir?" I asked.
"McGill, are you in command of that crazy group up high?"
Not exactly, sir." I quickly explained that Belter was leading the infantry, and I was leading the cavalry. "We've done rather well working as a combined arms force, if I do say so myself." Belter, eh?
Figures, he said. She's a grandstander, there's no doubt about it. So are you, for that matter. Could you be bothered to hold your position for the next several hours while more troops get up to you? No one else has advanced so far.
I checked my altimeter, and I had to admit I was surprised. We were about 2,500 meters up.
We'll gladly wait for the rest of you, I said. Belter's people are exhausted, and my dragons are about out of juice.
Understandable. We'll reach you by morning. Wind's laid out.
Morning? That wasn't encouraging. But night was falling, even as I looked around. Since Machine World had an 18-hour day, the transition from light to dark as night fell was alarmingly fast. The same was true in the dim gray light of every foggy dawn. Just to be sure I didn't get in the middle of an argument with my officers, I contacted Leeson to inform him of Winslade's orders.
Good, he said. We'll be up to your position shortly. This business of command confusion is bullshit.
I was wondering about that, sir. Who exactly is in command when we have so many different groups involved?
I knew the answer to my question, of course. Barring any special orders, the highest-ranking officer present was in charge at any given post. That meant Belter could give me orders whether Leeson liked it or not. If he wanted to change her orders, he would have to find someone higher-ranked or convince her she was wrong. In my opinion, he probably wouldn't have much luck in that department. Leeson knew all this, but that didn't stop him from complaining.
Belter is in charge by default. I hope she doesn't get your dragon smashed seeking glory. Maybe if Turov hadn't been so busy making side deals with Claver, she'd have set up an appropriate chain of command.
A small hissing sound came out of me when I heard him say this. How could Leeson know about Claver and Turov? There was only one way. Graves or someone else had told him. Eventually, this leak of information would get back to Turov. She'd feel like using her broadsides on the mountain then, focused tightly on my location.
Chapter 31. The hours that followed were long and slow. It was cold up here. We were squatting on the side of a spire of rock that seemed to reach right past the limits of this world's envelope of gases. I'd thought the flat plains down below had been cold, but I was wrong. Up here, there was even less to keep a man warm. It made me think of the fragility of every world. Planets were really oases in a vast, frozen desert known as space. The battle went on hold around us for the time being. The legions moved upslope all night long, and several units filtered into our defensive spot. Others passed on to take higher positions. The enemy was maneuvering out there, too. Somewhere, I could feel it. They weren't beaten yet, not by a long shot. They were probably hiding from our plasma artillery. The officers called a meeting with the non-coms as night fell swiftly over the mountain. Most of our forces were made up of infantry who hadn't done much fighting yet, but they'd done more than their share of dying. After the events of the day were analyzed, the commanders had determined the obvious truth. When infantry combined with cavalry, our formations operated more effectively. Consequently, we were told our dragons would be used to break enemy defensive locations wherever they were encountered during the rest of this campaign. The infantry would be sent in behind us to clean up.
That's just grand, isn't it?
Carlos asked me afterward. I mumbled in agreement with him. Being told you were no longer a fast-moving cavalry force, that instead we were destined to become an armored shield for the infantry— well, that wasn't what anyone in Winslade's cohort wanted to hear. We set up tents that were never warm inside, no matter how much hot air we pumped into them. To pass the time, I ate, slept a little, and tapped on my tapper. Various people sent me notes wanting to make sure I was still breathing. Mostly, these notes came from Anne and Natasha. They made me smile even as I answered and erased them quickly so the other girl couldn't find them later. Neither girl would be happy to see I was getting queries about my health from the other.
Kiwi showed up and rudely looked over my shoulder.
"Still at it, eh, McGill?"
she asked. Startled, I turned to look at her. "Just answering a few notes."
"Yeah,"
she said.
"Here's your goodnight kiss from me."
She kissed her hand and slapped me with it. I caught her wrist and pulled her down into my lap. Carlos brayed with laughter, and I let her go after receiving a few more slaps. She sauntered off. Her hair was disheveled, but she had a smile on her face.
"What's with you and her?"
Carlos asked.
"It's totally unfair, whatever it is."
"Honestly, I don't know. I have to admit, Kiwi and I have a strange relationship."
"Yeah, real strange.
The end result is you get to screw her and anyone else you can grab. Meanwhile, Carlos is lucky to pick up crumbs." I shrugged. "Kiwi and I do get together every now and then, but she always seems jealous of other women, while I accept her habit of entertaining any number of other men."
"Hey,"
Carlos said, scooting a little closer and lowering his voice.
"I'm hoping to get in on that action soon. You can help me out. Just don't let her have any. Not even if she begs you for it."
"What?"
"You know we're working on a project, right?"
he asked.
"We're working together to come up with a box to control these stupid machines. That's my in. Chicks love working on a cool project together and being told constantly how smart they are."
Shaking my head, I heaved a sigh. "That's not how you go about it, Carlos."
"Hey, don't be a hater, McGill. Can't you share the wealth a little? That's all I'm asking for. Besides, I'm just imitating you. I watch you play the ladies all day long."
"Whatever."
"Just starve her, okay?"
he asked, urgently.
"If she comes and tries to crawl into that spiderweb bag of yours tonight, push her butt right back out again. Preferably, you should aim her in my direction."
Carlos had never been easy to like. There was something about him that was swaggering and desperate all at the same time.
"You got it," I said, which got Carlos to leave me in peace.
I saw him pestering Kiwi later, and sure enough, they started working on some kind of gizmo together. We called lights out soon after that, and I sank into my sleeping bag of spider silk happily. It really did keep a man warm even on this ice ball of a planet. For once, there had been truth in advertising. Maybe the marketing man in charge had screwed up. I'd barely fallen asleep when someone actually did try to slip into my sleeping bag. This surprised me. I mean, really surprised me. I'd never thought that Carlos could have been right about something like this.
"Kiwi,"
I hissed,
"what are you doing?"
"I'm not Kiwi."
It was Della's voice. I felt a pang of embarrassment for the mistaken identity, but really I shouldn't have. I mean, what the hell was this married woman doing climbing on me in my sleep anyway?
"Oh," I said, what's this about, Della?" "I've gotten over being angry with you,"
she whispered back. This had me frowning bewilderedly in the dark. I hadn't known I'd done anything to make her angry, nor had I noticed that she was in such a state. What should I do now? These were new circumstances to me and presented me with a dilemma. Sure, Della and I had a past, and we were both non-coms. Fraternization should have been a no-brainer. Hell, we even had a kid together who was some 50 lights away. But she was supposedly married, and I'd just started things up with Anne, a woman I'd had a thing for that went back years.
"Okay," I said, carefully.
"I'm glad you're not angry, whatever it was I did." She squirmed into my spider bag, which really wasn't big enough for two, but it stretched accommodatingly. It had been warm before, but now it was getting a little steamy.
"Are you disappointed?"
she asked. "About what?"
"That I'm not Kiwi."
"No, not at all," I said. She was quiet for a time. I made no moves on her other than to get comfortable.
"Am I bothering you?"
she asked.
"You sure are. I was sleeping, and you're kind of freaking me out."
"Why?"
"Because you're married to someone else."
"Oh, we colonists don't operate that way. Jealousy is a primitive thing. We've moved past it in our culture.
I chuckled, not believing her for a second. From what I'd seen on Dust World, people were just as jealous as anywhere else. Hell, one little weasel named Stott had killed me over jealousy. An unexpected full moon face appeared above us in the gloom of the large tent. It was Carlos, and he was frowning down on us like the face of the Almighty himself.
"Could you two keep it down?"
he asked. The truth was, there was very little privacy at night in a tent full of your entire squad. Often on Machine World, there had been a screeching wind that covered up any noises people made at night. But tonight, it was dead calm outside.
"You're just as annoying as people say you are,"
Della marveled at Carlos.
"Look, McGill,"
he whispered,
"just screw her and get it over with. We've only got about 4 hours until dawn."
He went away at last. I hadn't made a single move on Della all this time. I had my arm around her, and I was thinking about doing more. But it just didn't feel right. A marriage was a marriage where I came from. She grabbed my arm, lifted it up to her face, and activated my tapper. Curious, I let her do it and looked on. She paged to my photos and vids section. She quickly found the shots of our daughter.
"You've looked at them, at least. Several times, in fact. I can see the date marks on the files. I'd half expected to find them all erased."
"Della, why did you come over here and climb into my bag with me?" She put her head on my shoulder.
"I'm not entirely sure. I just do what I feel like in these situations."
I could understand that, so I relaxed and tried to sleep, because that's what I felt like doing. I actually managed it for a few minutes before she started talking again and woke me up.
"This bag really is luxuriously warm," she said.
"Yes, it is. Now why don't you pipe down and let me sleep?" She fell silent for a time, but it didn't last.
"Don't you want to have sex?"
she asked finally. There it was, out in the open.
"Not if you're still married."
She sat up and looked me over curiously in the dim light.
"You really are a strange one, James McGill."
"You don't know the half of it, lady," Carlos said. His froggy voice came out of the darkness nearby, alarmingly close.
That kind of killed her mood at last. Della crawled out of my bag, gave me a tiny kiss on the forehead, and left. She went back to her own bed, and I sighed tiredly. I was out like a light after that, but I had troubled dreams for the few hours that remained of the night. Chapter 32. The gray stillness of dawn was split open by the roar of incoming fire. A bombardment began, one that consisted of green-lit falling objects. They reminded me of the globes they'd dropped on us back in Dust World. Those had been gas attacks. These globes couldn't be gas. We were all enclosed in vac suits, so gas was pointless. I made my way out of my tent into the cold of early morning. I could feel that cold even through my suit. It cut lines across my body wherever my suit folded up and allowed me to sense what it was really like outside my tiny enclosure.
"What do the squids think they're doing?"
Kiwi demanded, coming up to stand next to me. We watched as the green balls popped and liquid splashed the rocky walls of our shelter. They smoked there, melting the methane snow.
"I don't know what that stuff is," I said, "but I doubt it's meant to refresh us. Everyone saddle up, get inside your dragons, now!"
This announcement was met with a general chorus of grumbling.
"I haven't even taken a piss yet, Vet," Carlos said.
My people scrambled to obey quickly enough, however, when they saw one of the green globes wobble into our sheltered area and touch our big tent. The materials smoked for a moment, then the tent disintegrated. It sagged like a popped balloon. We climbed into our machines and got them moving. All around us, the infantry were ducking for whatever cover they could find in the cracks and crannies of the gully we were hiding in. I pitied the poor bastards. They didn't even have a nice temperature-controlled vehicle to hide inside of. They had to live like cockroaches exposed on the surface.
The genius of the squid attack became obvious when a rivulet of the green stuff ran down under the butts of a half-dozen crouching soldiers. There they were, 1 minute, trying to look in every direction at once. Then, in the next, their suits were unraveling, exposing them to the brutal elements of machine world. People howled and hobbled, their boots burned away, their legs smoked white. Any exposed skin quickly blistered due to the acidic liquid, then froze to a purplish gray as the frost had its way with them. Before I could request orders from Centurion Graves, he gave them to me. "McGill, it's time to advance again. The enemy has zeroed our position, and they'll burn us out of here one way or another. I think it's time we took the fight to them."
"Right, sir. Which way?"
"Check your HUD map. Follow the tactical display. You'll move straight upslope with Belter's unit behind you. The rest of the cavalry will flank."
Thanks, sir."
I checked on my orders. There was no clear endpoint to our advance. If I was a betting man, I'd say Graves had tapped a likely spot for the enemy position, then just ordered me to attack it, hoping there'd be someone to kill when I got there.
"What kind of intel have we got on the enemy positions?"
I asked. "Precious little. Natasha and about a dozen other techs flew buzzers uphill last night, but they were all knocked out before they were a kilometer off. We should have at least that far to go before we encounter serious resistance. It's my opinion that the squids have retreated farther upslope and are bombarding us now to keep us pinned, stalling for time."
"Your opinion, sir?"
"That's right. Have you got a problem with your orders, McGill?"
"Not at all, sir. I'll let you know when I find the slimy bastards."
I closed the channel and sighed. I decided to relay our waypoint to the squad, but not to pass on the rest of Graves's vague ideas. It was best if the squad believed we knew where the hell we were going. This march was different. The enemy didn't fire at us with small arms. Maybe they'd realized those attacks hadn't been all that effective yesterday. In fact, they'd only served to pinpoint their locations for the bombardment Turov had launched at the end. Instead, we marched into the blustery, frozen silence of machine world without facing resistance. It was eerie not knowing what might be 100 meters ahead. The dragons to either of my flanks were churning uphill, scrabbling on the slippery rock. They were like dark shadows shrouded by mist. Behind each dragon marched a dozen or more foot soldiers. Now and then one fell and had to be helped up. I knew some were already injured but terrified to tell their commanders. Under these circumstances, a lame soldier was a liability that would best be put down, to start over again at the Legion bases at the bottom of this endless mountain.
"Vet," called Kivi, who was on point. "There's something. Come look at this."
I goaded my machine's legs into a faster step. Soon I was at her position. What I noticed immediately was the mist. It was thinning out. There were gaps in the white sheets of stuff like drifting breaks in a thick fog. Not since I'd landed on this world had I found conditions so clear. I immediately communicated this fact to Graves.
"That's only to be expected," he said gruffly. "You're in a high-altitude zone. You've pressed beyond the fog layer, that's all. Now advance to your assigned coordinates and report in."
Ordering my squad to hold their positions and to be ready for anything, I advanced into the open alone. It was a strange feeling walking out of a fog bank that covered most of a planet. For the first time since I'd set foot on Machine World, I saw the sky itself. The heavens were blue-white. Another cloud layer, higher than the one that we'd walked up out of, hung overhead. Those clouds looked fluffy and white. I found them strangely normal and inviting. After getting a good look, I retreated back into the mists.
"McGill," Belter called. "I'm getting reports of the mist breaking up."
"That's right, Centurion. We're getting up out of the fog layer at last."
"That's not good. Not good at all. Hold your position, please."
"I've been ordered to advance to the point on your tactical display, sir. My orders are from Centurion Graves."
"Hold your position, please,"
she repeated crisply. I hesitated, then did as she asked. I ordered my squad to hunker down in the last shreds of mist. After about a minute, Centurion Belter got back to me.
"Do you know that your centurion is a callous prick?" she asked me.
"You must be talking about Graves," I said. "And yes, sir, that's a fair assessment by any measure."
"We're going to do this, but we're going to do this our way," she said. "I want you to charge to the designated coordinates. My infantry will follow as fast as they can."
Why the change of plan, sir?"
"Because I think the enemy is in the clear up there, waiting to ambush us. They'll cut my unit to pieces in the open air."
"Your people did all right when we advanced on forces at the foot of this molehill. You can hide behind our hulls, just like before."
"Listen, McGill," she said, seriously. "They couldn't see us before. Now, they'll be able to use their scopes. We're walking over bare rock, and most of my people are wearing the equivalent of pajamas. They'll shoot right through your legs and take my troops out, shields or no."
"In that case, why do you think Graves gave us these orders? Doesn't he understand the danger?"
"Of course he does. He thought of this long ago. I think his techs knew about the break in the fog. The sensors from the ships overhead should have given him a warning. He wants us to attack, so we'll hold the enemy's attention while the bulk of his force comes around a spur of rock and flanks."
Thinking about it and looking over the maps in my cockpit, I had to admit she was probably right. We were decoys, distractions. "You're saying as long as we attack," I said thoughtfully, "we're doing our part of this mission for Graves, just not exactly how he's ordered us to do it."
"That's right."
I thought about it, but after 10 seconds of thinking, my comm light was blinking again. It was Graves.
"McGill, what the hell are you doing up there? Get off your ass and get moving."
"Yes, Centurion, moving out now."
After closing the channel, I opened my squad channel and added Belter to the list.
"Cavalry, it's time to charge," I said. "The enemy might not be exactly where the map indicates they are. When we take fire, we'll veer toward that fire, and we'll destroy the enemy when we meet them."
Della spoke up.
"Permission to engage shields, sir."
"Denied. They'll slow you down too much. You're going to be left in the dust as it is with your heavier loadout. If you get in close enough to engage, you can turn the shields on at that time at your discretion. Sound off, squad. This is it."
They sounded off. No one seemed happy, but they were grimly determined. That was good enough for me. We transferred power to the legs of our machines and switched off everything else except for basic sensors and weapons. Charging in a dragon was really a matter of resource management. You had to put as much power into the legs as you could without crippling the machine's effectiveness when you reached the target.
"Charge!"
I roared, my voice distorting over the comm link. My dragon's legs began to pump, and all around me more than a dozen other vehicles did the same. We thundered about 10 sweeping strides upslope before we were out of the fog and in the open. How we must have looked to the enemy. Lumbering like giant predatory animals of metal, we tore up the slope with abandon. Titanium claws sparked and screeched on the stone. Inside my cockpit, my vision bounced and lurched as we crossed uneven ground. The infantry were racing behind us, but they were lost in the dust almost immediately. My lighter cavalry moved directly upslope at about 60 kilometers an hour over rough ground. This fact gave me a surge of pride. I wasn't aware of any ground force in history that could advance faster under these conditions. Some small part of me had been holding out hope that the officers were wrong, that the enemy wasn't waiting for us to break out of the fog and become instant targets for everything on the mountain. I dared to think that the green acid globes hadn't been dropped on us to goad us into acting. But these faint hopes were shattered almost immediately upon exiting the roiling fog.
"Incoming fire!"
shouted one of my squad mates. I didn't have time to look over my displays and identify them. A storm of small arms fire swept over my vehicle a second later. At first, it was all snap rifles, I was pretty sure of that. They splattered us, pitting our armor, but they didn't know enough to concentrate and penetrate. Not yet, at least. More green acid balls arced and fell. They had little effect on my cavalry, but I knew that the infantry in our wake would suffer. We charged on. Inside my cockpit, it began to feel a little warm. The engine was revving and had gone from a purr to a steady roar.
"Break right, 2 o'clock, I ordered. "Up on that snowy ridge, see them?"
We'd all spotted them by now.
My HUD outlined them in red and drew little arrows that pointed down to them when they came into direct view. Squid infantry, I was sure of it. As a group, we veered toward them. The fire became almost frantic. Still, they weren't focusing enough rifle fire on any single dragon to bring it down. I began to think this wasn't going to be suicide after all. We were only about 300 meters from the enemy, and already my comrades were chugging out grenades. Enemy contacts blinked out when we scored a kill.
"Incoming missiles," Della called. "We've got 7 seconds. 6, 5, 4.
"Spread out," I ordered. "But keep advancing. If we get into the ranks of the infantry, they won't be able to pound us with artillery without hitting their own troops." With a whoosh and a boom, the first missile landed behind us, sending up shattered rock in a spray. A half dozen more landed a second later. They were smart mini-missiles. The later members of the missile swarm learned from the hits or misses of the first ones. 2 dragons were taken out, struck dead and sent rolling down the mountain in a cascade of flame and fragmented metal. I didn't even know who died. I didn't have time to worry about that. We reached the snowy ridge moments later. The squids, to their credit, rose up to meet us without showing an ounce of fear. It was an uneven contest. We were encased in titanium with limbs powered by fusion. They were only determined balls of muscular flesh. We manhandled them, tearing off tentacles and throwing the writhing limbs down to steam in the snow. It was a slaughter, but I reminded myself it would have been just as grim if squids had caught and abused our light troopers. 12 of the enemy went down before they got smart. They backed away, spraying concentrated fire at our legs. 1 machine went down on 1 knee. It was Carlos. I could see his nameplate. He stopped advancing, but he didn't fall. He balanced painfully on his knee and used his grenade launchers to great effect. The squids tried to close with him to finish him off, but he stopped every attacker that loped in his direction with a well-aimed grenade in the guts. The rest of them we tore apart. A full company of enemy squids were wiped out. The troops cheered and smoke roiled around us. "Centurion Graves," I called, puffing inside my helmet. "We've met and defeated an enemy formation. We lost 2 dragons, and 1 more is damaged."
"McGill," he said, "I'm checking on your stats. You're out of position. You left your infantry behind. Worse, you fought the engagement without my flanking troops to help."
"Sir, would you have rather had me stand on the slopes and wait? We were taking fire from every direction."
"Right, those mini-missiles. Fine, I hereby approve of your tactical decision. In fact, I want you to repeat it."
"Pardon me, sir?"
"Take the next ridge. Look up slope, man."
I craned my dragon's chassis back to gaze uphill. Now that we'd exited the fog bank, the mountain looked more imposing than ever. I could see it in all its pristine glory. The mountain was formed like many others, but with the vertical look that all geologically young mountains had. A series of sweeping ridges and stair-stepped plateaus rolled upward seemingly to touch the sky itself. Centurion Belter's troops straggled in as I looked upward. They were puffing and spent. They'd covered the rough ground as quickly as they could, but I couldn't expect them to keep up if we pressed onward.
"Sir," I said to Graves, "Belter's people can't run any farther. They've reached us, but they need a rest. My dragons have power levels that are halfway down to the red, too. Besides, I just lost 3 vehicles, 20% of my force."
"Are you complaining, veteran?"
"I suppose that I am, sir."
Graves fumed for a few seconds.
"All right. Wait for the rest of the column. We'll regroup and decide how to proceed. Hide your dragons under an overhang. There are more mini-missiles appearing on the screens now."
These final words goaded me into action. I shouted for everyone to disperse and hug up against a chunk of solid rock. We rode out the next storm of missiles and then endured 3 more waves before Graves arrived with his much larger force. Seeing what we were up against, Graves requested support from above. Turov launched an attack, and the mini-missile battery was silenced. Chapter 33.
When we finally began moving upslope again, we had a lot more troops. There were about 70 dragons, nearly half Winslade's remaining force, and about 1,000 infantry. Strung out in a long ragged line, my dragons led the ground troops as before, providing them with cover. Graves still wanted to charge in if we ran into enemy resistance, but so far there wasn't any. Probably the strangest thing about our new formation was the personal presence of Primus Winslade himself. He was riding a dragon around in the rear ranks. This surprised me as I hadn't known he'd been trained to operate one of the vehicles. Carlos beeped my private channel, and I opened the connection with a sigh. "What's up, Carlos?"
"You know what's up. I'm screwed."
"Yeah, pretty much," I agreed. This time, Carlos had a serious reason to complain. His machine had been too damaged to fix in the field. The techs had looked it over and shaken their heads. They left it behind in the snow, and he was transferred to the infantry. This had resulted in an unending fountain of complaints.
"This is what I get?" he demanded. "This is my legion's idea of a hero's thank you?"
"That's right," I told him. "Only in Varus, it's more of a heroic kick in the pants."
"I must have killed 30 squids in that last battle, all while I was on my knees."
"30? I asked, as if scandalized. "You wiped out 70, or I'm a liar."
"You are a liar, McGill."
"It's one of my best skills," I admitted. He was suddenly quiet, but not for long. Carlos was never quiet for long. Even when he died, it seemed like he popped back out of the revival machine with his mouth wide open.
"What's with Winslade?" he asked. "Am I blind, or is he marching at the back of the line in a dragon?"
"You are blind, but you're right. He's driving a dragon like he knows how to do it."
"I bet he got private lessons from Della, just like you did last night." "Hey, I just thought of something. Why doesn't he give me that dragon? He's not going to fight if there's another battle. He'll hang back and do nothing. You watch."
"Why don't you ask him about it? I'll patch you right through to his private chat line."
"No thanks, asshole," he said.
I thought he might shut up then, but no dice.
"Hey," he piped up a moment later. "That last fight was pretty cool, wasn't it? We charged right up there and smoked those squids. They probably didn't even know what was coming. I think the ones I killed inked themselves at the end."
"That's their blood," I said. "It's darker and thicker than ours, almost black."
"I say it was ink."
"Fine, it was ink." He was quiet again for a minute.
"You know I'm going to die in this infantry unit, don't you?"
he asked.
"Belter's crazy, and her solstice troops are looking at me like they want to pop me right now and get it over with."
I frowned. "Maybe you'll live, maybe not. Centurion Belter has gotten her troops this far. You're exposed, but the cavalry is the top priority target by now."
"Belter is a real ballbuster. She loves death almost as much as Graves does. I know I'm a dead man. I can feel it."
"So what else is new? Time to shut up now, okay? I'm trying to listen in on the planning session." I closed the line with Carlos and tuned into the command chat line. Graves and his officers were discussing our next move. We were advancing now, but not directly upslope. We were spiraling around the mountain, trying to avoid their concentrations while gaining altitude. The squids, for their part, seemed to be playing a waiting game. We passed camps that showed they'd been here in force but had retreated. They didn't seem eager to face us head to head. I couldn't blame them for that. So far, they'd lost every pitched battle. But why were they playing for time by retreating? Did they have a surprise waiting for us? We had no way of knowing.
"I've got Turov looking for enemy concentrations and dumping on them when she finds them," Graves said into my ear. "But there's suddenly a big lack of squids out in the open since we bombarded their mini-missile brigade. Either we got them all or they went underground."
That made me frown. I'd seen more than just squid camps on the way upward. I'd seen evidence of native machine life as well. Big divots in the land that left shiny marks of the kind a backhoe might have left in rocky soil at home. We hadn't seen any native machines, though, only squid infantry. Of course, the big machines might very well be in tunnels in the regions of pure ore higher up. I wondered if the native machines could digest titanium, and what it tasted like if they did.
Probably it was something akin to steak with a fine wine for them. We trudged upslope for about 3 solid hours before we reached a good sheltered spot and let the troops rest. The dragons needed to recharge as well. When we got started again, more than half the daylight had gone by. Nearly half the mountain had been climbed, too. I have to admit that by the time darkness began to fall, I'd been lulled into thinking this march was pointless, that we'd hurt the squid so badly the last survivors would be hunkering down somewhere, scared and hoping we didn't find them. Such fantasies were ripped apart just as the sun began to set. The big white ball of heat known as Gamma Pavonis had actually peeked out through the clouds now and then, dazzling our eyes and glaring blindingly on the snow, which was melting in the slight warmth the star provided. That was when I realized something about this planet. It had big mountains down where we were now, around the equator. There were no real seas, but there were spiky mountains. And where they rose up into the sky enough to pierce the clouds, they revealed their frozen methane to the sun now and then. At that point, the white star melted the frozen methane, transforming it into the thick mists that coated the planet. Everything in the mist froze again, and the cycle was repeated. All around us, as the frost melted, sheets of hanging white mist rose up. It was like walking in a sauna. At first, I could see every trooper and dragon on the slopes around me. But after half an hour of sunshine, they were vanishing one by one. When darkness finally came, the enemy attacked. They came out of nowhere. That's how I remember it. Looking back, I'd have to say they were in tunnels that had been buried by the snow. Maybe they'd purposefully buried themselves. I was never sure afterward. The squids themselves, in close, weren't that much of a problem for our cavalry. The real problem was presented by the native machines that joined their attack. There had to be at least 50 of the big machines. They rose up from under the ice where they'd lain in wait in our path like landmines the size of buildings. They heaved up, tossing men and dragons aside, sending them tumbling downhill in an unstoppable avalanche. One minute we were marching along, minding our own business. The next, we were in the middle of dozens of heaving hills of frosty machines. In between these, we were faced with armed and armored squid troops. The confusion was overwhelming. Every channel was full of shouting troops and the sounds of panicked, dying men. I muted the general command channel and switched to squad chat. That way, I'd only be dealing with my own group. In this kind of mess, there was no front line. There were no formational tactics. We were in a pitched battle at close range. I knew that if Graves really wanted to get a hold of me, he could do so on the unit channel. "Squad, don't panic. Here's what we're going to do. I want you to pull in tight and put Della's group in the center. Her heavy mounts are the only ones carrying spinal cannons in our squad. Della, link up, focus fire, and take out one machine at a time. Dragons with grenades, keep firing on the squids. You know the drill." Indeed, Della and the rest did know the drill. She marked her targets and called her shots. The machines began to blow up around us, one at a time. The process seemed slow and imperfect, but it was working. The machines themselves were undisciplined, as usual. They humped over the ice, gobbling up running heavy troops one at a time and munching on the metal. When they took down a dragon, that took them longer, but they still rasped and churned until the job was done. This gave us the time we needed to take them out. "McGill," Graves said in my ear after we blew up our fourth target and were maneuvering to hit the fifth.
"Sir." "Are you listening to command chat?"
"No, sir, I'm destroying the enemy."
"Normally I wouldn't complain about that, but Winslade's calling for you. He's in trouble and he wants you to save his ass."
I didn't roll my eyes, but I wanted to.
"On my way to his position."
"Sir, I don't see him on my display."
"That's because a machine ate him. He was all alone in his dragon, and apparently he tempted the wrong machine."
"Heading to his last known location, sir. Permission to take Belter with me for support."
"Granted."
I relayed the situation to my cavalry squad and to Belter, who loosed an impressive stream of profanity.
"Not only do we have to march up this icy rock in our underwear, now we have to save Winslade's butt, too?"
"That's about right. Let's move out."
"Wait, we'll go in first."
This puzzled me for a second.
What?
You heard me, Specialist. Stand your post. My infantry will save the worthless Primus Winslade.
But, sir, how will you deal with the machine?
We'll roll under that thing's skirt and light up grav plasma grenades. You've seen us do it before. If you punch a hole in that machine's upper armor and pound shells inside, you'll only kill Winslade anyway.
Right, okay. We'll back you up.
I watched Belter's infantry rush the machine, and I had to admit, it was just as impressive a sight as it had been the first time. Carlos tried to connect with me, but I was too busy to listen to his complaints. His light went out about 30 seconds before the machine heaved up and died. I grimaced. He'd bought the farm, for sure. Reflecting afterward as the enemy broke and fled with us, peppering their backsides with our guns, I realized Carlos had been right. Belter was a real death dealer. She liked to get into it, and she was more than willing to lay down the lives of her people as long as the mission was accomplished. When we dug Winslade out of the debris, he was still alive. He looked frightened, but he pulled it together when he saw who we were. I ordered my squad to encircle his position while he climbed out of his wrecked dragon and dusted himself off.
"That was excellent work, McGill," he said. "I knew you could pull off this rescue."
I looked around for Centurion Belter, but didn't see her.
"The infantry really did it, sir," I said. "They came in under the machine's skirts and took out the guts of it."
"Really? Where is Centurion Belter?"
We both looked around, then checked our tappers. She was on the dead list, waiting for revival back at base camp at the bottom of the hill. Carlos's name was just two slots below hers.
"Looks like this unit needs a new commander, sir," I said. "You could appoint Adjunct Leeson."
"What? Leeson? Nonsense. That man is more than unimaginative. He's downright slow. Turov has said it herself."
I looked around, hoping Leeson wasn't hearing this. Fortunately, I didn't see him.
"I'm taking command of this unit personally,"
Winslade said. Rotating my chassis, I looked him full in the face.
"You, sir? An infantry unit?"
"Yes. I'll have to have a dragon, of course. I'd take yours, but you're too damned good at fighting in that thing. Which of your squad members is the least effective?"
Blinking, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. "You want to take another one of our last fighting dragons and use it for a jeep, sir?"
"That's not how I would describe it," Winslade said, with his eyes narrowing.
Trying to think fast, I came up with a dodge. "I'll come up with a name, sure, but I'm surprised you're missing out on an opportunity like this."
"What do you mean?"
"Chances to stand out in front of the brass and garner medals for action don't come every day for a new Primus. But you know how to handle your career better than I do."
"Yes, I do, but wait a moment. Are you suggesting I do better on foot?"
"Well, not everyone is a glory hound. Not everyone wants to showcase their versatility in combat either. No, you're probably better off staying in a dragon, sir. You just got the rank of Primus anyway. This auxiliary cohort will probably be rebuilt to full strength when we get home. No need to show anyone you can lead infantry as well. The conclusion will be obvious to anyone back on Earth that you can." Winslade said, looking around doubtfully. A few of Belter's hard-bitten group were leaning on their rifles, crouching in the snow and staring at us. They didn't say a word, but I had to wonder if a few of them might not end up hating me for this.
"McGill, I've come to a decision," Winslade said. "I'm marching with the infantry until Belter can be revived to relieve me."
"I see, sir, very well."
I quickly trotted my dragon away from him before he could change his mind. I organized my cavalry squad and moved closer to Graves, fearing Belter's troops might shoot me in the back. Chapter 34. The ambush attack turned out to be all the squids had left in them. They didn't come at us again after that. We mopped up a few small concentrations of the enemy and chased off machines that became overly amorous toward our dragons and other equipment. The mountain of pure titanium ore was ours for the taking, and we took it.
We found large mine shafts in the region where we'd fought the squids to a halt. The enemy had been hiding in these shafts that went deep into the mountain, and the clear evidence was that they'd been here for some time.
This was their central encampment on the planet's surface,
Graves said as he inspected the mining machine.